Welcome to the Center for Investment Excellence, a production of J.P. Morgan Asset Management. The Center for Investment Excellence is an audio podcast that provides educational insights across asset classes and investment themes. I'm David Lebowitz, global market strategist in our multi-asset solutions business and host of the Center for Investment Excellence. With me today are Sam Sokwar, global head of research within our global fixed income, currency, and commodities group, as well as Brian Coleman, head of private credit strategies for J.P. Morgan Asset Management. Sam, Brian, welcome to the Center for Investment Excellence.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, I'm excited for our conversation here today. And you know, as a lot of our listeners know, there's a group within J.P. Morgan Asset Management called SIAG, the Strategic Investment Advisory Group. What we do is we put together these longer form pieces to think about things that are happening across the economy and across the markets, which may not be reflected in kind of the day-to-day trading and day-to-day economic releases. These are more thought-provoking pieces. And so I'm really glad to have both of you joining me on the podcast today to unpack some of what we covered in the credit paper, just to give everybody a high-level sense of the direction we took. First of all, lending and credit creation, it's central to finance, it's central to economics and key for economic growth. And so we thought that this was the best place to really start the conversation. Over the past 10 to 15 years, really since 2008, we've seen significant growth in the private markets. And as I noted earlier on, that line between public and public markets and private markets is becoming increasingly blurry. And we want to talk a little bit about what that may mean. I think more than anything else, what we're looking at today is, you know, in a world where there's a new investment framework or investment universe, right? Things aren't necessarily the way that they've been historically. Investors need a new lens through which they look at opportunities in that world. And hopefully we can unpack some of that here today. And so, Sam, maybe I'll kick off with you. Let's start with the public markets here. You know, how do you think about the credit spectrum today in light of all the changes that have been observed over the course of the past 10 to 15 years?
Sure. Just to level set, the public credit market today is broad and it's deep. So it spans a very wide credit spectrum from the very high quality, highly liquid to the lower quality and less liquid ones. Now, what we've observed over the last 25 years is a huge growth in actually in the public credit market. So for reference, the US IG market has gone from about $1 trillion in 2000 to over $6.5 trillion today. U.S. high yield went from $0.5 trillion to $1.3 trillion. EM, hard currency credit, which is probably a newer asset class, stands around $1.5 trillion. And euro credit, so that we don't forget about, that's about $2 trillion. So this market is really big. It's diverse and it's nuanced. So what we think is that for investors, this really does offer a very wide and interesting risk-adjusted return opportunity set. And I think it really there's a benefit of having a combination of a bottom up and a top down approach. So an allocation from the top down and alpha generation through the bottom up selection.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. And I want to stick with that theme of security selection, because one of the things that people have been talking about quite a bit over the past few years are rising stars, falling angels, so on and so forth. And again, you know, not only do I think the line perhaps has been blurred between public credit and private credit, but the line between investment grade and high yield is looking a bit blurry or less defined, I should say, than perhaps has been the case in the past. And so can you talk a little bit about that dynamic and how you think about evaluating opportunities that are sitting on the border of those two credit classes?
Sure. I mean, so that you've got this invisible line between investment grade and high yield, but actually for a lot of asset allocators, this tends to be a pretty hard line. What we've observed actually is that in the public credit markets, there's been a convergence around this triple B, double B rating bucket. So in investment grade, what we've seen is that the lower end of the credit spectrum, the triple Bs, has risen in size. So back in 2000, this accounted for about 30% of the index. Today, it's closer to 50%. in high yield, we've seen the opposite dynamic, whereby the higher end of the credit spectrum in high yield, the double Bs, has risen in size. So that now is around 50%. It used to be around 30%. So, you know, what we've also seen is companies sort of navigating this invisible line, drifting between that triple B and double B. So when the economic backdrop is more supportive, you're seeing the double Bs, you know, credit quality improve and rising through that invisible line, as it were, to investment grade. When the more stressed environment, we're seeing the triple Bs migrating through this line and going as fallen angels and into the high yield space. So what we're seeing companies are trying to do is sort of to optimize the sort of sweet spot of the optimal leverage levels and you know, maximizing return for shareholders, whilst at the same time finding that right mix of funding, you know, access and funding costs. So, you know, companies are doing that. And what we think is that investors should also be taking a more flexible approach to allocation across the credit spectrum. So not to be limited by this hard but invisible line, but rather broaden that scope to maximize risk-adjusted return.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. And one more question for you on the publics, and then Brian, I want to come to you and talk a little bit about privates. So, you know, a lot of people say high yield is a higher quality asset class today than it has been in the case. And I think part of what you were just getting at is that, you know, the higher quality credit, i.e. investment grade, may be looking a little bit lower quality in aggregate, and high yield has seen the inverse occur. But can you put some facts and figures and maybe a few examples as to how you've seen the quality of high yield increase over time?
Sure. So, you know, I think go back to 2000. At that point, the high yield market was really an LBO financing market. So for small companies, a median company of around 200 million EBITDA. Today, that medium company has an EBITDA of around 700 million. So high yield companies now have scale, they have size, they have diversification, and they attract really strong management teams. So it's no longer niche. As I talked about, you know, the investable universe is now, you know, very much a higher quality, double B rated. And then another interesting observation, I think, is the resilience of high yield spreads in recent years. You know, partly you could argue that is because of more benign environment, but I think, you know, it's a testament to the maturity of the asset class and the improvement in the fundamental of the fundamentals of the issuing companies.
Excellent.
One reference point I would say is that, you know, high yield market actually peaked at $1.5 trillion in 2021, but over the last 2 years they've lost $200 million in market cap to investment grade companies. So these rising stars, they've lost $200 million in market cap, which has pierced through that invisible line we spoke to. So this talks about the improvement of the credit quality and this sort of blurring of the lines that you spoke to.
I think that's a key point. It's almost like getting called up out of the minor leagues to go play in the major leagues, to use a sports analogy. But, you know, you mentioned that 20, 25 years ago, the high yield bond market, the purpose it served was really to finance buyouts and, you know, provide financing for private equity. We very much have seen private credit come in, particularly over the past couple of years, and take up some of that slack, maybe not as much from the high yield market, but more so from the bank loan market. And I would say, broadly speaking, you know, there's been tremendous growth in private credit. There's a lot more to private credit than just direct lending, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But, you know, what does the universe look like from where you sit, both in terms of the types of strategies as well as the types of deals that they're investing in?
Sure. So let me touch on the growth aspect first, and then I can talk about the breadth of the private credit market. So if you look at just direct lending, you know, it depends on the source, but I think we've seen growth of around double, essentially, from $750 billion to about $1.5 trillion today in the direct lending market. But and that's growth that's attracted a lot of attention, no question. I think that when you look at the drivers behind that, really the vast majority of direct lending is to provide debt financing to private equity. Mm-hmm. And private equity has correspondingly grown very strongly. And so part of that growth is just simply increasing along with the market size. But, you know, as you said, there's also been a market share driver as well. And so that in the core middle market is coming at the expense of regional banks and community banks, which have increasingly ceded market share, and that's driven by regulatory capital charges. And then, you know, increasingly in the last couple of years, we've seen private lenders step into where the broadly syndicated loan market would typically be the source of funding for a company. But those are the drivers. Really, it's about growing with the market and some market share increase. In terms of the breadth of the private credit market, you're absolutely right. It's a lot broader than simply corporate direct lending. And so when we're allocating our investors' capital, we're looking not only at performing debt, but also special situations or distressed debt, and then across different borrower and collateral types. So real estate, commercial real estate debt, residential mortgage debt, consumer and SME, et cetera. And that, you know, it helps in a few ways. Number one, some of those areas can be quite attractive relative to corporate lending. Number two, you're obviously getting some diversification benefit from your from doing that. But so it's a very broad market.
And I want to just hone in on direct lending, because that's the elephant in the room, right?
Sure.
Every conversation I have with an institutional investor, they're either already allocated to direct lending, they're in the process of allocating to direct lending. People are viewing it to an extent as a silver bullet. I don't really believe in silver bullets, so I'll just ask you directly, is direct lending in a bubble? What's your take there?
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of things in life. It's not a silver bullet. It's not the golden age. So, you know, you have to kind of take people that are selling direct lending with a little bit of grain of salt. But correspondingly, I also don't think it's a bubble. I think that, you know, you pick up the paper every day, you read alarmist stories. You know, that might be just to generate clicks, or it may be lack of understanding about what's happening in the market. But, you know, if you look at factually in terms of credit metrics, in terms of pricing, there's nothing really to suggest that we're in a bubble. I think if I had to guess, if there was going to be a problem in the future, it might be at the very upper end of the market, where some direct lenders are competing with the broadly syndicated loan market, and so they're going to have to take broadly syndicated loan terms, and that could lead to problems down the road. But at the moment, I think we're in a fairly balanced market, frankly. But you always have extreme views on both sides.
Exactly. And I think, you know, part of what drives this sentiment is that you've seen, as you noted, such substantial growth that there are bound to be a few bad apples amongst the bunch, but doesn't necessarily mean that the asset class overall is at risk. And speaking of risk, Sam, I want to bring you back into the conversation as somebody who, you know, oversees fixed income research broadly, but really has, you know, an expertise in the public markets. It feels like we're in this world where borrowers kind of have their choice of where they go to get funding. And so why do you see borrowers that maybe historically have played in the public markets moving into the private markets? And how do you think about the benefits versus the risks of being on one side of that line versus the other?
Sure. I mean, I think for borrowers, there are a few things that the private credit market offers them. One is speed of execution, flexibility around the structure and terms. And obviously, in a situation where they get into a distress situation, there are fewer lenders to navigate around, so a resolution can be quicker. But however, this does come at a higher cost of funding, so that's something that they need to bear.
Excellent. And then, you know, while we're talking about risks, Brian, maybe I'll give you the last word on privates. So I've looked at private credit for not as long as you, but a handful of years now, and the data's not great. It's somewhat opaque. And so, you know, given what Sam just said about the reasons why people would go to the private markets versus the public markets, what are you seeing in terms of defaults, amendments, overall loan quality. You mentioned that at the higher end of the spectrum, right, some of these lenders are forced to compete with the broadly syndicated space, where we know CovLite has been an issue over the past couple of years. But what are you seeing from a fundamental perspective across, you know, direct lending in particular, but perhaps private credit more broadly?
Yeah, so first I'd say you're right. Public sources of data are lacking, and so the market is a bit opaque for people that are not invested in it.
Yep.
That said, if you are invested, you're getting a tremendous amount of data. And from what I can see at the moment, you know, the market, as I said, it's pretty well balanced from a leverage perspective. The big driver right now, given the increase in base rates and the fact that these are floating rate loans, is debt service coverage and fixed charge coverage. And so out of the gate, loans today are, you know, most lenders are targeting sort of 1.5 to 2 times coverage. Mm-hmm. And that's caused other leverage metrics to come down. So LTV and debt to EBITDA are materially lower than they were pre-2022. If you look at pricing, it's been elevated in the last year, but coming down, trending back towards kind of more normal levels. And documentation is still good. I think that's a major distinction, frankly, between the core middle market and broadly syndicated loan market. But it's a market that's in decent balance. And so, you know, again, going back to the question about bubble, I don't see it at the moment. Yeah.
Excellent. Very helpful. Well, thanks to you both for your time today. I think this was a really interesting conversation and hopefully gives folks a sense of what we covered more broadly in the written piece. A couple of takeaways from my end. Again, one, you know, public and private markets are very much converging in the credit space. Public markets within themselves are converging to an extent between investment grade and high yield. And, you know, as we don't see as much distinction across these various asset classes, again, we think investors will need to be more nimble, they'll need to be more flexible, and they'll need to take advantage of the fact that, you know, the occasional dislocation in one market may not present itself in another market, but that can effectively be a call for action, a call to action, I should say, when it comes to thinking about portfolio opportunities. And so with all that said, thank you both very much again for your time, and looking forward to having you back on the podcast again soon.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Of course.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us today on JP Morgan's Center for Investment Excellence. If you found our insights useful, you can find more episodes anywhere you listen to podcasts, on our website, and on our JP Morgan Asset Management YouTube channel.
This content is intended for information only, based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.